Thanks, man. Good job. My name's Eddie. I'm a recovering alcoholic. We good? Thanks a lot, Heidi, for asking me to speak. Thanks, microphone dude, for helping with the mic. Tika, thank you for your lead on Tradition One. Really helped me to, like, be in a meeting. You know, the fishbowl thing totally blew my mind. And totally made me forget everything that I was going to talk about tonight as well. So, what do you call it? I am an alcoholic. When I say that I'm an alcoholic, what I'm talking about is I got a physical allergy to alcohol, which is an abnormal reaction to drinking alcohol. When I put alcohol in my blood, it triggers an unstoppable physical reaction that calls for the next drink. And, you know, what do they say is I take a drink, and then the drink takes a drink, and then the drink takes me. And that doesn't happen to just everybody. And the other part of the illness, alcoholism, I have is the mental part, which I come to respect as the most dangerous part of the illness, which is the mental thing that where I can't remember that I can't safely and successfully drink alcohol. And that's just one part of the mental part, which I hope I'm going to talk a little bit about that in recovery. But that being said, this is also information that I didn't have. Somebody could have brought to my attention sooner. Probably not, though. They would have told me. I don't think I would have believed it as a kid. There's a chapter, anyway, I like talking about the book Alcoholics Anonymous. There's a chapter in the book Alcoholics Anonymous called A Vision for You. And this, for me, is one of the best part of all the AA literature. It's one of the things that I come to appreciate now that I've been clean for a little while. But it starts out in this chapter talking about what we used to think about alcohol. For normal people, a normal person thinks about alcohol like this. And it also is what I used to think, the positive association we used to have with drinking. It means relaxation and being creative and connecting with other people and blah, blah, blah. I'd probably be able to quote it exactly what it is once the adrenaline dump, like, wears off of being speaking in front of what looks like the entire tri-state area is here getting sober, which is awesome. It's great. But anyway, so the fun times, the good times when drinking worked and when it was fun and when it was workable for me, that was when I was 14. When I was 14 years old, I had already been drinking for a couple years, several years, and we drank all this beer in the basement of my friend's house. It was during the summer, and we went outside from something about going from the cool basement of drinking the beers out into the heat of being outside and then into the drugstore where it was air-conditioned and then come back outside, and I passed out. And it was one of those where your eyes are open, but the window shade goes down, and I fell down onto my face. I basically, like, laid down, you know, from a full standing position and just crashed my face into the sidewalk. And I crawled around on my hands and knees, and I crawled around by the edge of the building. I leaned up against the wall. I was sitting down, and that was my I had arrived moment. I felt good. You know, I'm bleeding from the head, and I feel like I'm Clint Eastwood or Butch Cassidy. You know, you light up a cigarette, and you're watching people go by, and I was, and a normal person doesn't have that association, but I remember around that time was when I make the decision I'm going to turn my will and life over to the care of alcohol. And I was in a meeting this afternoon at lunchtime, and somebody said it was alcohol. It was life on alcohol's terms as opposed to life on life's terms. And that was when I made that. I like to say it was that day. You know, I don't know. But I know that what it felt like. And it was special. You know, my sponsor likes to say, I'm not an alcoholic because of what alcohol did to me. It's what it did for me that makes me different. And it didn't do that for just anybody. I mean, it was a special thing for me. And the first, looking back now, it makes sense. You know, the first casualty of the drinking lifestyle for me was my education. I was smart. I was supposed to be smart. I was supposed to be a scientist or a professor or something. And what I did was laid siege to my brain cells with poisonous quantities of alcohol and anything else I could get my hands on from the very beginning. And I was shot out. I graduated high school by the skin of my teeth. I graduated high school. They let me get my high school diploma. I had And I set up a pattern for me that was one of the patterns that ran throughout my drinking story, my drinking career. My drinking career, which is one of these AA. Look it. If you're calling your drinking a career, you got a problem with alcohol, all right? You know what I'm saying? You're probably an alcoholic. I know it says in We Agnostics what the description of it is, but you could add that, you know. And I learned, the pattern I learned throughout this story is when you get in a jam, I immediately stop drinking. And then I start talking. And I want to think about it, and I'm going to say the right thing, and I talk my way out of it. Let's make a deal. Get on my side. Come on, let's work together on this thing. Whatever it takes to make it right, I'm going to make it right. And I squeaked out of high school, and I went away to college, and things got much, much worse. Got much harder to talk your way out of it. And I don't know. What do you want to? It's a horror show, you know. From that point, I got punched in the face when I was in college. I lost my glasses off the balcony or somewhere, and I started wearing my contact lenses. I had an old pair of contact lenses. And the thing about wearing contacts is you're supposed to take them out, right, before you go to sleep. And when you don't never know when or where you're going to go to sleep, you wind up waking up with your contacts spot welded to your eyes, you know. And that, you know, performing surgery every morning to try and get the contacts out. I was still trying to be an artist. I went away to art school. And the thing about the casualties, what happened was, and the real pattern, you could tell the crazy stories and stuff, but the pattern here is that when things got in the way of my drinking, it had to go. So I compromised. When I got to art school, I went from I'm never going to drink ever again, I swear to God and everybody else, to like I'll drink once in a while. And like I said, I had the allergy. So I'm off to the races, and it became... I want to be an artist, so you know I'm not going to go to liberal arts. I'm not going to go to English or geology. Forget that. I'm an artist. And then after a while, so I'm going to be an illustrator, so I don't got to go to photography or you know, I'll cut those down until eventually I stop going to drawing class and I'm drinking around the clock. I can't go outside while it's still light out. I got to wait till it gets dark out before I go outside. And at the same time, you see other people start to thrive and explode into like lives. Like we're going to get engaged into the community and we're going to do this awareness and have shows and girlfriends and cook food and things that escaped me. You know, what has he got that I don't got? And he drinks. You know what I mean? So anyway, I got thrown out of art school. And, if you've ever been thrown out of art school, you probably got a problem. It's really hard to do, but you know, it's not that hard. If you don't go, they tell you, look, you know. And so I moved in with my father and in Brooklyn, in the railroad apartment in Brooklyn, me and my father, just till I get on my feet, just till I get a job and I get an apartment, just for a couple of months, I'll stay with you. And it took over, I think it took about a year and a half, maybe more, before I was able to fully detonate that situation with... what he would start to recognize, even from his perspective, was pathological, dishonest behavior. Wasn't the drinking even so much for him, but it was the dishonesty. He knew, you know, and he was shocked. You're looking me right in the face and telling me that, and I would look at his teeth. You know, I wouldn't look in his eyes. I would look in his teeth and lie, you know. So I get the gate. You know, I move in with a roommate out in Queens, way out on the F train outside of the city in Queens with a roommate, a bartender friend of mine. And that was a horrendous situation as well. It gets worse. There's a progression here. You know what I mean? It doesn't get better. It doesn't go away. It doesn't, you know what I mean? It wasn't going to pick up. It wasn't, things were not going to start looking up for me. The where I wound up, you know, the end of my story is very like, you know, I don't even know how to talk about it anymore. I used to be more clear. Remember when you knew you could tell your whole story? Now it seems like I don't know. Anyway, I wound up creating an environment for myself in this place in Queens. It was upstairs in a two-family house. I had one room in the back. And the environment that I created for myself was a disaster. I crashed on a futon pad on the floor. It wasn't a futon. It was just a mattress. It was flattened out, and it had turned black from the toxins that I was sweating out of my body every night. And I had an empty case of Georgie vodka that I used as a table. And I would be next to this mattress pad on the floor, and I took a black magic marker and I used to write things on it. I was reading the Bible at the time. I'm reading the Old Testament and the New Testament, Jonah and James and Job and all these stories, and I would pull things out of the text and I would write it in black magic marker on this cardboard case, empty case of vodka, like an escaped mental patient, basically, is how I was living. Thank you. I had like the half-empty containers of Chinese food, the empty tall boys with cigarettes put out on them, mounds and mounds of unwashed clothes. I had, what do we say, the alcoholic method of doing laundry, which is basically like the weight from the clothes on top creates a pressure that cleans the clothes on the bottom. So like what you do is you pull, as long as you keep pulling out from the bottom, you know, that's the fresh clothes, you know. And I had the, anyway, you know, and I had bags and bags of unopened mail. I couldn't open my mail. I couldn't answer the phone. So, you know, I'm shot. I'm basically shot out. And it was much, much more disgusting than that, believe me. But, you know, you look at Atlantic, it's like, how do you, you don't want to do that. But what happened was, and here's the thing, the end of my story, I don't even know how much is real at this point, how much really happened, but I'll tell you this much. The salient information at the end of my story seems to be this. I had an employer. One thing was I had an employer that took an interest in me. I was I was working freelance. I was working, what do they call it, independent contractor. And when I didn't work, I didn't get paid. And I didn't have a, anyway, it was crazy. But this employer liked me. For one reason, she took an interest in me. And she was a little wacky. She was a little new agey, but she was tough as hell. And she was cool. People were afraid of her. But I just was magnetized towards this lady, this employer that I had. And she used to look at me and she told me, you know, I like you. You're great. But, you know, you're not here. I can't keep you. It breaks my heart. She'd say to me, you disappear for 3-4 days at a time. I don't know where you... I couldn't show up. So when I bottomed out, I started bottoming out, I called her. Because, all right, I'll tell you what. I called her, why? Because I don't want to lose my job. But what I did was I told her the truth for the first time. And if you answer phones at Intergroup or you work with somebody that's an active alcoholic, every once in a while, you'll get a call like this. And it's amazing getting it from this perspective. But I made that call to her that it's like... It's like the call from, it's a transmission from outer space, basically, right? You're calling from another dimension. It's always these hushed tones. I got to talk to you. Listen, I got to tell you something that's very important. I want you to listen very closely, all right? I think there's really, really something wrong with me. And she's like, who is this? What do you know what I mean? It's like, it was like 12 monkeys, you know? If you've seen 12 monkeys, I'm calling from the future. I had a spider and I ate it. It's like, Cole, you idiot, you know? Like, what are you even talking about? And I'm like, I got to meet you for a cup of coffee right now. And she's like, I am not meeting you anywhere. I will not meet you. I am not going to see you. And her attitude, she did not have to read the chapter to employers. She knew a person with their head screwed on straight. Her whole situation was, you're going crazy alone. You know what I mean? And she said, you need help, go get help. And that was the beginning. You know, she sent me to see a psychotherapist. And this is the other thing I'm not really square on. I'm going to try and wrap this up because, you know... Here's the other thing that seems to be obvious is that I sit across from the psychotherapist and I'm ready for anything at this point. I mean, I get into therapy, I tell this lady, I describe to her the symptoms of alcoholic depression, which is what I got at this point, right? Boom. And she says to me, and this is the mental part of the disease, this is what blows my mind more than anything else. She says, well, do you drink alcohol, you know? And I'm like, what? Why? What are you talking about? Now, this is after several failed attempts to manage and control my drinking, several honest failed attempts to stop drinking entirely, and she tells me, do you drink every day? And I don't understand the question. I honestly don't understand the question. You know what I mean? I'm looking at it like, what are you driving at? You know, like, what? I'm in therapy. I'm going to kill myself. I'm standing back away from the edge of the subway every day. And I'm saying, give me the pills. Give me the electric shock. I mean, I don't know what you got from me, but this cannot possibly be about drinking. And she gave me a meeting book and she said to go to a meeting and I went and I got drunk and it was around this time I also got 12-stepped. And I have to say, Michaela G is a recovering addict and alcoholic who carried the message to me. It was around this time. And she said to me, I gotta quit drinking. I'm not going to AA, but I gotta quit drinking. She said, I quit drinking. And I was like, really? She said, the easiest thing I ever did was quit drinking. And I was like, and then she said, the hardest thing I ever did was stay sober. And there's a part in Bill's discussion of step one where he says, when one alcoholic puts in the mind of another alcoholic the real nature of his problem, that person will not be the same again. And I was not the same after that. And I drank again almost immediately after that, but it was not the same after that. And I walked into my first AA meeting like, I don't know, by my count, it must have been even 15 months after that. And it was horrendous, the last couple of whatever it was out there. But I walk into the Mustard Seed Group in 1992, and I haven't taken a drink since March of 92. That's my sober date. I got a sponsor right away. I get plugged in, and I guess I got a couple minutes. I want to say the best thing that one of the things that this therapist told me, she said, when you get to AA, find a friend. Get one person you could talk to. She knew that I was almost phobic about being around other people. So she said, if you get a hold of one person, you got to get one friend. That was my assignment. And I'm hanging around, and I got a sponsor right away. Steve B was awesome. His girlfriend was amazing. His girlfriend would straighten me out more than my sponsor. She really looked out for me. So I was plugged in, and the fellowship, you want to do it, it's like, how do we say? The fellowship sustained me long enough until I could start to get my teeth into the program. I don't know why I'm really even thinking about my first friend in AA was a guy named Lawrence. We called him L.A. And L.A. had like 2 years. He was a special guy. And that was my best friend. And I heard him share in a meeting. I stuck out my hand, and I said, dude, I really like what you said in this meeting. And I followed him around. To me, he was like 007. He was like Batman, James Bond, all. And I thought I was going to be like him. I thought it was appropriate for me to try to be like him. I didn't know, like, I got to learn how to be like myself. But I just love this guy. You know, and it was sober a couple of years, and he was up for some charges from when he was out there. He had a court date, and we went out to New Jersey, and we showed some support for LA, and there was a chance he was going to go right from court directly to jail. It's not like go home. And I was going to say goodbye to my best friend. Batman was going to go to jail, and I was terrified. And we were in the little room, and his attorney came in and said, it doesn't look good. And I'm going, you put me on the stands, I'll be a character witness. And I was shot out of a, yeah, you know what, that's not a good idea. I was like the human space heater of crazy as a newcomer. And this guy looked out for me. Now he's going away. And we went in the bathroom of this courthouse, and we got down on the floor on our knees and prayed. And I remember him praying. He said something. It might have been the third step prayer. But you know what? I know what it wasn't. What he didn't say is, get me out of this and I'll never do it again. And he didn't say, please let it be a hung jury, which is what I was saying. Like, let him, like, get off. But he said what we do here. And now the reason why is impress on me is that he knew that I was the new guy. And what he showed me is, this is how we do it. This is how we do it. You know what I mean? This is the gesture of step three. So that more than, I mean, you talk about doctor's opinion, we agnostics, how it works, the formal 1, 2, and 3. But and you know, I did the Joe and Charlie, the Big Book Comes Alive, and the home group and the sponsor. But this guy showed me, demonstrated right in front of me. And I thought the miracle of that story, that second step miracle, was he got off. But the real miracle is in my first several years of sobriety, when I had the death in the family and my girlfriend tried to commit suicide, and I had a physical injury and chronic pain and surgery. People had to take care of me, and the IRS came after me. I called my sponsor, and I made it to my home group, and I practiced the step I was on. But I leaned back on the experience that I got from this guy and my sponsor, who demonstrated to me, said, this is how we do it. When it gets like this, you suit up, you don't drink, right? You suit up and show up, and we go forward. You do not run away. And that, to me, is the demonstration, you know, of what we do in here. The rest of it, what? 4, 5, 6, and 7, personal house cleaning is tremendous. You know, it's important. I was out in the Park West group, and I heard somebody share that if you're like me, you know, like many of us, you come in here, we got these tremendous ego and very low self-esteem. And what I thought, and what she said, what I felt like is, I thought that my gigantic ego was self-esteem. And I thought my low self-esteem was humility, right? And it turns out, that's not how that works, all right? And 4, 5, 6, and 7, for me, that personal house cleaning is, write down on a piece of paper the truth about yourself. Talk to another human being about the truth about yourself. 6 and 7, you spend that time in prayer and meditation, you start to deal with the truth. So I have more, better information about who I am, for real. But nothing, you know, 8 and 9, you really want to say, nothing, in or out of AA, changed my perception of myself and life and the world more than steps 8 and 9. The physical act of visiting the people in institution that I had difficulty with, to get in somebody's face and say, I'm here about the harm that I've done, there's things that I did that I should not have done, and there's things that I should have done that I did not do. And I'm here to try and make that right and then get out of there. It changed my perception of myself more than anything else. You know, 10, I got a great 10-step format from Bruce P., who's my sponsor, who's a member of this group, gave me a 10-step that rocks. It turns out that every time I have any kind of emotional disturbance at all, of any kind, I'm afraid. And it's always the same two or three fears for me. It's the same self-centered fear. So that troubleshooting fear, that's 10 step, becomes extension of the inventory in 4 through 9. And then 11, which again, you know, you can't really talk about too much. I find it difficult to explain step 11 without sounding, you know, whatever. It's difficult. It really is. You can say what it's like, but you can't say what it is. But the one thing I like about 11 is at the end of 10, it says, these things start to happen automatically. There's a healthy instinct starts to assert itself. I don't have to figure it out. Thank God. It's not so much like figure it out, and it becomes to emerge. The healthy instinct starts to rise up. And then 12, you know, working with other people. I was at PAX recently, and thanks, man. They said, there was a dude that was like, I don't help other alcoholics because they're sick. I help other alcoholics because I'm sick. Now, I try not to be confused about that. Now, there's a lot of things in AA that sound like a contradiction, but it's really not. And I love that about AA. What do they call it? It's like a paradox. It's this, but it's also not. And I just love that because it changes and whatever. It stays fresh. But this idea that I got to help other people because I'm sick, I don't like to claim sickness for myself. I don't like to claim insanity for myself. I'm still crazy. And in one sense, you could say we are recovered. I don't have a problem with that. I don't say that's wrong. Well, I've recovered from a hopeless condition of I can't stop drinking and I can't stop thinking about alcohol. But I could still absolutely be freaking Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Jackass, like in 2 seconds, if I don't stay on board with these guys. And the guys that I work with, my sponsees, the guys that I've been able to work with, when these guys take these concepts and principles and I see them install this as a way of life, not just reading it or talking about it, but when they demonstrate that toughness, the mental, the emotional and spiritual discipline of take this out of the book now and go and do it, it creates this feedback that, to me, it fuels the enthusiasm that I have. And that's the value, you know, of that. The rest of it, what? In all our affairs, that's what it is. What can you say? I will say that I can't. That being said, you know, you talk about what the inspiration that you get from these experiences in my past. I cannot kid myself to believe that this experience that I have now, tonight, is going to keep me sober next week or tomorrow. I can't say that. You know, I can't expect that. So I got to keep it moving, man. I'm going to try. I try to do this every day. I was talking to my friend Linda last week. Guess what? You know, we get to be here for this. Yesterday, Chinese New Year. Anybody? It's amazing. We got the new president is installed. The Steelers are in the Super Bowl. It's big for me. I'm from, Western Pennsylvania, represent. And we get to appreciate these things. Not just that I was there, but I'm awake. We're not half conscious. I'm not half dead. You get to pay attention, to this. And I appreciate that. So, and thanks a lot for asking me to speak here at Atlantic. I appreciate it. Thanks.